Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we'll hear what is happening in the New Hampshire primary.
Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, and Donald Trump, they all visited the airport diner in Manchester, New Hampshire, and worked the room and talked to voters.
We consider if Saudi Wahhabis are related to ISIS. We'll talk about the nosedive of Japanese stocks and take a look back at the work of American singer-songwriter Dan Hicks. It's right here on the Voice of America. The first U.S. presidential primary is underway in the northeastern U.S. state of New Hampshire. It's a balloting that could prove to be a make-it-or-quit event for some candidates. Following the action there is VOA's Catherine Gibson, who joins us on the line. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Susan.
Hey, how has voter turnout been so far?
I was out and about this morning talking to voters and had already seen a couple of people who had already voted, some Kasich supporters and some Trump supporters. So, you know, people are already getting out there, and it really helps that we have a bright, clear day here. The snow has stopped, and that should really help with voter turnout.
Well, New Hampshire folks are used to the snow anyway. It's snowy
great.
And rainy here. So what are the candidates up to today?
Well, I actually have already seen Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, and Donald Trump. They all visited the airport diner in Manchester, New Hampshire, and worked the room and talked to voters. So they're still getting in their campaign stops, even though it's primary day.
Did they all come together or one at a time?
One at a time.
So they didn't share a cab.
That's correct. Or breakfast.
Were they making any remarks about today?
You know, they were just greeting voters, encouraging them to get out to vote, and, you know, the usual campaign stop.
And what is the sentiment in the state about this election? It's a first primary.
Well, people are very excited here. You know, up until the last minute, I was at a John Kasich rally last night, and people were still making up their minds between him and Jeb Bush and, you know, still getting in that last little face-to-face interaction with a candidate so that they can make a final decision. They really go up to the wire here.
When will we know how it's looking?
They count votes throughout the day, so when polls close at 7 p.m., we should have a pretty good idea of who is in the lead.
7 p.m. local time, that is.
That's right.
How are the voters making up their minds with all these candidates running around trying to impress them?
Well, a lot of them are waiting for the opportunity to ask the candidates questions face-to-face and hear their responses and compare them with their other experiences at other rallies and campaign events. They really have a sense of, I want to look at each candidate individually and then sit down and compare them all. And if that takes them up to the last minute, then that's how it'll work for them.
Donald Trump has been quoted as using some offensive language, shall we say, on the campaign. Is there any reaction to that? Are they offended?
You know, the voters that were greeting him at the diner this morning didn't mention his offensive language at the rally. You know, last night, it seems to be par for the course with Donald Trump. He's said some very inflammatory things in the past, and I think people are just getting used to that, how his campaign events go.
Maybe it's just part of his persona now.
I think it is. I think that's a very good way of putting it.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Catherine. Enjoy your day.
Thanks. You too.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today concerning this story. And joining me with the tales is social media reporter Andrew Palchewski. Welcome, Andrew, as always.
Thanks for having me. Well, New Hampshire is, of course, the big story today. And, in fact, we've already had a vote in Dixville Notch that Bernie Sanders and John Kasich have won. And a lot of people on social media taking that news, even though it's only, I think, 11 voters or so, and saying, oh, well, this is an early lead for them. So a lot of kind of tongue-in-cheek on social media about
their... Yeah, it's a long day for those candidates.
It is a very long day for those candidates. And as usual, as we saw before Iowa, we're seeing a lot of back and forth between supporters and the candidates themselves and their campaigns. Of course, now it's a new realm, social media, for reaching out to voters, for advertising, for all those kind of things.
Yeah, so it's interesting because just a few years ago, this was new, social media is so new. And now it's just built into their machine, into their political machines.
Exactly. And in places like Iowa and New Hampshire that are such retail politics, it's still a lot of shaking hands and going to diners and things. But social media has now supplemented that, where you can target on such a micro level to specific voters, and you can outreach to specific voters. And especially in places like Iowa and New Hampshire that are such small states population-wise, it's really, you know, critical for these campaigns. So I would be interested to see how social media plays a role in New Hampshire. I'm sure it will play a role for sure. The campaign certainly will spin it that way, saying, oh, well, we had better digital outreach and we had this and that. And the supporters are spinning that now, even before the vote is finally tallied.
And the thing about social media is, if you go stump somewhere at some high school or something, only the people in the auditorium can hear you. But if you send out just the tiniest little tweet, you know, two sentences, everybody in the world practically can get online and see what you had to say.
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, now you see with things like Periscope and Facebook Live video, even if you're not in that high school auditorium with the candidate, you're seeing that candidate beamed around the world because people are showing the video as it's happening. This is what we saw with Iowa in the caucuses. We saw a lot of people taking video from inside this very unique voting process. So it's not quite as unique in New Hampshire with the voting. It does run throughout the day, the primary, more like a traditional election. But I wouldn't be surprised to see people, you know, going to vote and doing live streaming video from the campaign events. And certainly tonight, as the results are announced, we're going to see a lot of video from some of those rallies where the candidates are either celebrating or maybe packing up and heading home.
That's right. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
We know Antarctica is the land of snow and ice and is the coldest place on Earth. But believe it or not, this polar continent was once quite warm due to the different, earlier atmosphere. Antarctica was covered with lush vegetation and teeming with a variety of life, including dinosaurs. An international group of scientists, supported by the National Science Foundation, have begun a month-long expedition to Antarctica to look for proof that it may have been where a number of today's species got their start. Most of any fossil evidence of such rich and diverse life is likely buried beneath the continent's incredibly thick ice. But those heading up the expedition will focus their search in areas where rocks containing fossils are more accessible, such as on James Ross Island and others just off the Antarctic Peninsula. They hope to find fossils that date from the Cretaceous through the Paleogene period, some 100 to 40 million years ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
For the first time since August 2013, forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad are within 25 kilometers of the Turkish border in northern Syria. They continue to press a Russian-backed offensive that is throwing moderate rebel forces into disarray and despondency, say activists and insurgent commanders. Turkish officials are warning that the round-the-clock Russian air sorties and heavy fighting could spark the arrival of as many as 600,000 fleeing Syrian civilians at its border. That has Washington alarmed. Josh Earnest is a White House spokesman.
Russia is enabling the Assad regime as they carry out terrible acts of violence against innocent civilians. These are military actions that are being conducted in rebel-held areas, but there are innocent civilians who are the victims. And that has led to an atrocious humanitarian situation in a variety of communities in Syria. And the situation around Aleppo in recent days has only worsened. We continue to be concerned about this. We continue to speak out against the actions that are taken by the Syrians, and we continue to urge the Russians, who are enabling them, to stop doing so.
Secretary of State John Kerry, meeting in Washington with his Saudi counterpart, Adel al-Jaber, Monday, expressed hope for a ceasefire and humanitarian aid for civilians trapped in the fighting.
We are deeply engaged in trying to get the International Syria Support Group to be in a position to be able to move towards full humanitarian access and a full ceasefire, which is in accordance with the UN Security Council Resolution 2254. And we hope that when we meet in Munich in the next few days, we'll be in a position where we can make progress in that goal.
After their meeting, the United States welcomed a Saudi offer to deploy special forces to support a coalition ground operation against the Islamic States in Syria. Regional analyst Abdul Qadir Sino of Indiana University tells VOA that may be only the beginning of a wider regional intervention, since Russian airstrikes have ushered in what he calls a major change in the direction of the conflict. For many Saudis, the word Wahhabi represents the teachings of the purest form of Islam, a religion that preaches peace, tolerance, and charity. Others argue this particular school of thought also houses hardliners who share ideology with extremist groups. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Riyadh and Jeddah in Saudi Arabia.
The concept of Wahhabism means different things to different people, and to some people, very little at all. Many people in Saudi Arabia, including politicians, students, analysts, activists, academics, and local businessmen and women, tell us it was only about 10 years ago that they began hearing themselves described regularly as Wahhabi. Veteran Saudi journalist Khalid Al-Maina is a former editor-in-chief of the Saudi Gazette.
There is no national religion in Saudi Arabia. The religion is Islam. There is interpretation and misinterpretation. There are people who misinterpret it. There are hardliners. Some of the hardliners who speak are similar to the hardliners in ISIS, but that's not the government speaking.
The hardliners he speaks of in Saudi Arabia share some ideology with Islamic State militants and other extremist groups on issues of women's rights, blasphemy, and retribution for crimes. In Saudi Arabia, women need consent from male guardians to make the most basic decisions, and apostasy is punishable by death. The death penalty is usually carried out by public beheadings. Saudi Arabia does not recognize religious freedom, and non-Muslims are not allowed to practice in public. But Islamic State militants openly kill Christians, Shia Muslims, and others as a matter of policy. Saudi Arabia does not. And scholars in Saudi Arabia say it is unfair to compare Saudi practices carried out by the state under Islamic law to extremists that revel in murdering, raping, and enslaving anyone who disagrees with them, including Saudi Arabia. Gulf Research Center in Jeddah chairman Abdelaziz Sajer says Islam excludes terrorism.
The Saudi Mufti and the Saudi religious leadership have always said that ISIS has nothing to do with Islam. All what they are doing has no relation to Islam, and they totally condemn all the act, behavior, belief that ISIS have said or have done.
What Saudi Arabia and Islamic State do share is the teachings of 18th century Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdel Wahhab, who preached the strictest interpretation of Islamic law. An interpretation, says some Saudi religious scholars, not followed, but perverted by extremists. Islamic studies professor Ali Omar Badhada of King Abdulaziz University in Jeddah agrees. He says Wahhabism has been largely studied in the West only recently, and mostly through the lens of understanding the extremist groups that claim to follow similar teachings. As a result, he says, it is the media, as much as hardliners, making some outsiders conflate Wahhabism with the ideology of terrorism. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
Coming up on International Edition, Japan's stocks plunge, and a look at the contributions of musician Dan Hicks. Japan's stock indices nosedived, and the yield on the government's benchmark bond turned negative for the first time today, while the yen surged to a 15-month high. To talk about all this with us is correspondent Steve Herman in Tokyo. Welcome, Steve.
Hello, Susan.
What does this all mean?
Well, it means that there is a lot of nervousness among traders in Asia especially, and everyone seems to be just looking for what they consider the most safest and conservative investment at this point, and it is certainly not Japanese stocks.
Is this linked to what's been going on in China?
Well, that certainly has a role to play in it. I don't think we can blame everything on China this week, especially because the markets are closed on the mainland and elsewhere for the Lunar New Year holiday. But I think we also have to look at the United States and rising concerns about a recession in the U.S. is playing into this, as well as the negative interest rates that the Bank of Japan recently instituted, and concern that that's really not having much of an impact in getting the Japanese economy to come out of its long period of being quite moribund.
Is the Japanese government doing anything or saying anything about this?
Well, the only statement we had during the day was from the Japanese finance minister, Taro Aso. He lamented about the negative interest rates for the key government bonds, and also commenting on the Japanese yen going to a 15-month high, which is something export-dependent Japan doesn't want to see. He called that rough, which is quite an understatement, actually, and just made that typical line that, you know, the Japanese government's going to continue to monitor developments in the currency market and the bond market.
The Japanese market is kind of a pillar of markets in the Asian regions in the past, hasn't it been?
Yes, and I think some of this right now is being exacerbated because we have so many markets closed and so many traders away for the Lunar New Year, and just a general nervousness. But, you know, as far as the Japan market, it does look at what's happening in the United States, in Europe, in China, as well as a continuing pessimism about the Japanese economy itself.
So maybe next week after the holiday, things will be a little better.
That is the hope, but you know, we've still got a couple more trading days this week here in Tokyo. Thursday will be a holiday, so everyone will get a break, but there's a lot of nervousness to see what happens during the Wednesday session after this horrible day for Japanese stocks, Nikkei 225 plunging 918 points. That was almost 5.5%.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Steve. Appreciate you talking with us.
You're most welcome, Susan.
This is VOA.
This is Green Bay for a healthier planet.
There may be gold atop the minaret, but a new mosque being built in Massy, France, is definitely green. Mahmoud Ismail is a member of the Muslim Committee of
Massy. We thought that in Islam, ecological principles have existed since the 14th century, and nowadays the world is coming back to this.
Ismail says there are invisible, environmentally friendly elements incorporated into the structure, such as double insulated walls. Then there are more apparent green aspects of the mosque.
We have the reminder of traditional mosque elements, that's to say the minaret and the dome. But now both have new functions. The minaret is a light well for the entry hall, and the dome, which became a glass dome, brings all the light to the big prayer room.
Ismail says the environmentally friendly mosque cost about 20% more of the total budget, but he says the money will eventually be recovered. Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
American singer-songwriter Dan Hicks, known for his popular blend of folk, jazz, and country music, died on Saturday in California after a two-year battle with cancer. He was 74 years old. International Edition Steve Norman has this look back at Hicks' career.
Hicks was known as the leader of the acoustic band Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks, which was a contemporary band of the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane in the late 1960s San Francisco psychedelic scene. He never achieved as much mainstream success as others from that era, but he was highly regarded by fellow musicians.
It's a baby with a channel. It's a cowboy with a channel.
At his commercial peak, Dan Hicks recorded several successful albums for Blue Thumb Records, including Where's the Money, Striking It Rich, and Last Train to Hicksville. One of their big hits through that period was Shorty Falls in Love, featuring the Lickettes. That's right, the Lickettes, Marianne Price and Naomi Eisenberg, plus the rest of the Hot Licks, Sid Page on violin, Jaime Leopold on bass, John Gerton on guitar, and Dan Hicks vocals and guitar.
Trip to Spain was so insane we could hardly watch the bull.
Luckily the rain that day was full.
Just as well as my heart fell the day you became mine.
Taking memories with you now, we have ourselves to tell the time.
As we sped around the world to see who we could see.
But I saw you and you saw me mostly.
Dan Hicks and the Hot Licks disbanded in 1973, and Hicks went on to work in a range of arenas, performing on movie soundtracks and with other ensembles, including the Acoustic Warriors. But he later said life was best when he and the Hot Licks were making music like Milkshakin' Mama.
Well, I went down on the street.
Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
I was real hungry.
Yeah?
Yeah. And I saw a malt shop.
Yeah?
No, yes, I did. And I was out of know that love.
Love?
Yes, love was waiting for me. As I sat down at the counter with the menu in my hand, I saw what was behind it. I hit a grand slam. I saw my soda fountain, baby.
Soda fountain, baby.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In recent months, the strategy to ultimately defeat ISIL has begun to reap rewards. Part of that strategy included deploying more U.S. Special Operations Forces, expanding training efforts for groups fighting ISIL, acquiring better intelligence, and improving targeting. It is fair to say, said Secretary of State John Kerry, that our persistence, our unity, our concerted commitment from every different country is all making a difference. Recent successes include the recapturing of Ramadi, Baiji, and Sinjar by Iraqi forces. In Syria, the Syrian Democratic Forces have retaken thousands of kilometers of territory from ISIL and cut off their supply routes. The Iraqi city of Tikrit has been liberated, where more than 90% of the population has been able to return and begin to rebuild their homes and lives. Some 10,000 coalition airstrikes assisted in making these victories possible. These sorties are hammering ISIL's heavy weapons, its training camps, its oil fields, supply routes, cache sites, and infrastructure. In addition, more than 90 mid-level or high-level leaders of ISIL have been killed since last May. These sustained efforts are hurting ISIL's finances, as evidenced by reports that ISIL has had to cut the pay to their fighters by 50%. Ultimately, said Secretary Kerry, the war against ISIL is going to be won through our local partners on the ground. Coalition members have trained nearly 20,000 regular Iraqi and Peshmerga soldiers, as well as more than 1,000 Iraqi police officers. The challenge now is to relentlessly push ahead with this strategy, giving ISIL no safe havens in which to hide. That requires doubling down on choking off ISIL's revenue sources. Coalition members also need to provide sufficient funding to stabilize newly regained territory. Beyond financial support, the government of Iraq needs assistance with removing thousands of lethal explosives that have been left behind by terrorists. And in Syria, diplomatic efforts to find a political solution to the crisis must produce results. At the same time, the international community must address the pressing humanitarian needs of the Syrian and Iraqi people. through a sustained military effort and financial and humanitarian contributions by every member of the Counter-ISIL Coalition, said Secretary Kerry, I have no doubt we are going